listening to Third Eye Cinema, your source for in-depth discussion of cult cinema. Tonight we speak with SOV cinema maestro Tim Ritter on the Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio. Cinema, where the focus is on film that matters, cult, grindhouse, drive-in, independent, and underground film from the dawn of the talkies through the early 90s. Tonight, we present the second of two interviews that birthed Third Eye Cinema. This one runs much closer to what became the Third Cinema Show format and was originally aired live in somewhat looser form on our sister show last year. We've tightened things up to keep it moving and given a bit of a tune-up to the proceedings to make them more listener-friendly, exclusively for airing here on Third Eye Cinema. There are over 14 films in the shot-on-video indie cinema genre. Tim sold the script and took the director's reins on Truth or Dare right out of high school at the ripe old age of 17, a film with national distribution and outside investor production cost approximately $250,000. Since then, Tim's given us no less than 4 Truth or Dare films related to Mike Strauber and the viral nature of the cult serial killer celebrity, plus such fan favorites as Killing Spree, Creep, The Twisted Illusions, and Dirty Cop films, and perhaps most interesting of all, the unusual but affecting slasher/black comedy/exploration of spiritual belief reconciled with the Christ. Join us as we speak to Tim Ritter, only here on Third Eye Cinema. In our first segment, we'll be discussing metal, some major thematic concerns of his films, and selling his first video out of high school. Tim Ritter, who is famous among certain circles for several independent John Video movies, chief among which would probably be the 4 Truth or Dare films, the Mike Strauber films, but also films such as Creep and Dirty Cop No Donut and Twisted Illusions, and one I'm going to be referring to in a bit, Reconciled with the Christ, which is interesting because it comes quite out of left field, but definitely fits in and is definitely a Tim Ritter film in every respect. So, Tim, I'm going to start off and ask you this. On your website, you describe yourself as an independent filmmaker and heavy metal enthusiast. Well, first off, let me congratulate you since I'm a fellow metalhead since the mid-80s.
Yes, and it's always we both are.
Always a pleasure to speak with a fellow diehard. Do you follow any of the more current bands, or are you more or less locked into the glory days back in the 80s?
Well, like the current band, a lot of them are still going if you look for them, like Accept.
That's true.
UDO, Judas Priest, Iron Maiden, you know, all those guys. Mm-hmm. So, but I mean, yeah, as far as current acts, if it sounds cool, I will definitely, and it comes to my attention, I will definitely give it a shot, so.
Right, because, I mean, my take as I follow all this stuff is, like, there's not a lot of value happening here in the U.S. We're still stuck in that whole new metal kind of aggro thing. But
Europe, a lot of this stuff is Europe, exactly.
Europe has really kept the flame burning. There's been a lot of reunion tours, like you said, a lot of albums from back there, and put anything out for, like, 20 years, and there they are again. There's bands that never gave up, like Saxon. And there's a lot of the stuff that was in the subgenres that I was listening to, like, you know, death metal, thrash metal, all that. These guys really never gave up, or they're back together. And we've got a couple of retro revival bands that are trying to capture the old sound. We have bands like Widow and Cauldron and Devil's Blood. They're doing stuff like 70s rock and 80s metal. And then we have bands like, you know, power metal bands, goth metal bands like Crypteria, Leaves Eyes, Rhapsody, Camelot. I was just curious if you were following any of that stuff as well.
Oh, yeah, here and there. And then also, like, some of the industrial stuff like Aesthetic Perfection, and they're pretty... Daniel Graves guy. It's kind of metal mixed with electronica, Nine Inch Nails. And they call it like dance rave music, but I don't understand that category too much. But it can be pretty intense and very soundtrackish. That's the word.
So. Now, getting on to your movies, I'm going to switch on a big thematic question first, so hang in there for a second. Many of your films revolve around mind games, hallucinations, and self-delusion. The Twisted Illusion short that inspired Truth or Dare, especially 1 and 4, and Reconciled to the Christ, those come immediately to mind when I'm talking about this. But this isn't just limited to the characters in the films, but it's often inferred that the viewer's perceptions of the events taking place might be skewed, kind of like the Italian Giallo film. for example, Wicked Games, there's actually three killers in the end just to keep everyone guessing and make literally everyone wrong about who it really is. And that's even before second twist ending, which may itself negate everything we'd seen before that. And in Killing Spree, it isn't until fairly late in the narrative that we see Tom Russo's misreading his wife's romance story, which she's intended to keep as a surprise until she makes the sale, as if it were her actual diary. In both the True to Dare films and Reconciled, the main characters hallucinate recurring protagonists who don't actually exist outside their own minds. Typically in your films, the audience is strung along with the characters with the big reveal that 50% of what you thought happened never actually did, or in reality is something very different from what you believed it to be. What's the genesis of this orientation, this fascination with the nature of reality and metacognition, where reality is actually far more subjective and determined by our view of ostensible facts than most people might suppose?
It's kind of, I guess it goes back to like kind of dreamscape in the original Nightmare on Elm Street with that kind of rubber reality that was kind of entering into, you know, movies then as I was watching them, you know, growing up into a teenager and trying to become a movie maker. That was fascinating. And I think another thing that really affected me when I was like 15 or 16 or something was Robert Bloch's Psycho, the novel. His novel is, the storyline is very similar to the Hitchcock movie, but of course the novel is very different also in the way that it kind of unfolds. And the way it unfolds is you're dealing with this character, Norman Bates, and of course, you know, the mother, everybody knows that the mother is in his mind and he's created this entire world. And it was really shocking to, you know, really read it from the perspective of this character and then have it all, so many things turn out to be, you know, in his mind. And I think those are two things that are really, really, you know, kind of influenced me in that period of, you know, where you're discovering horror movies and horror novels and books. And of course, Phantasm and stuff like that have a strange kind of sci-fi line on what's real and what's not. I mean, it's just an interesting thing to do, and it's something that if creative, it's an approach you can take that is not costly if you can do it right, you know. So there's a lot of advantages to it. And then plus also, as a independent movie maker, if one of your actors bows out or somebody quits or gets mad, you can just pull that rubber reality thing in there and kind of change things as you go and keep the project going without losing it. So there's a lot of advantages to it. I would say those are the two strongest early things that kind of, and like I said, it's something that kind of interests me, you know, perception, what is real, you know, what is not real, like I think in Videodrome, it's like, you know, it's your perception is the reality of your perception, and you know, what you view and what you absorb is, you know, your own reality, and if you experience it, you perceive it as real, and it just gets into a real complicated thing like you kind of described there, and it can be real fun to try to do that without making people irritated also. And that's another line that you've really got to do, because, you know, if you're watching a movie and then the whole thing becomes the last hour was all just a dream, you know, that can really upset people sometimes.
Right.
So you try not to do that too, but you try to integrate it cleverly, and sometimes you succeed and other times you don't.
Along the same lines, but going a little deeper maybe, you're delving here into the boundaries of what can be viewed as quantum mechanics and theoretical physics, or if you prefer, magic or faith and prayer, depending on whatever your orientation is. Do you have any interest in studying any of those areas, or is it more of, you know, just picking up from the movies as you had mentioned, or is it more of like a 60s style like hallucinogenic trip thing, or where did this really originate from? Because it really does permeate through your films as a whole. I mean, it's almost in every one you can see this happening.
Well, again, I think it just comes from the same thing, that whole feeling that maybe, you know, a lot of us have sometimes. You know, what is real? You know, what is your experience in it? How are you perceiving things? And that's where differences become in, you know, come into people, and you're like, oh, you know, did they, you know, their interpretation of what they saw is much different. Like, if five people see an accident, you know,
right,
might get, different. I mean, it's the same set of events, but you're going to have everybody adding in, you know, their different, perception of what happened, and maybe even the motivation of what happened. And as that tale goes on and on and on, it gets more convoluted and strange and even different.
Very true.
So it's kind of I guess I've never really thought about it, you know, in the depth that you're thinking, but you know, probably comes from, you know, just, you know, tapping into that and not even realizing it, and you know, the different books that I've read. I think Stephen King explores. I'm a big Stephen King fan, of course, and he explores
right.
a lot of his books. You know, the different realities and stepping in through a doorway that's like a. I mean, I guess it even goes back to like Star Trek, the old TV show, which is, you know, among one of my favorites. The classic classics, right. That is. Like the, what's that episode where Spock with a beard, I think there's even a band.
Oh, Mirror Mirror, yeah.
Exactly. So it's like, you know, they step into this other reality where everything's the same, yet it's different. All different personalities. So it's just, it's actually really fun to kind of play with that kind of stuff. And even in life, you know, there's certain times where you might, you know, go into work or you go, you know, somewhere that you're used to going to, and there's been some very strange changes where you look around and you're like going, is this, you know, where you're momentarily kind of jarred going, this is a little odd. Was it always like that? Or
right.
Is it something new, you know, kind of like the dream within the dream that Shakespeare would.
Right, I was thinking of the dream of the butterfly and, you know,
like
talking heads once in a lifetime kind of thing. You know, you wake up and it's like, who am I? You know, what have I done? Why am I here?
Yeah, and the surrealism of Cronenberg's early works, of course. You know,
yeah, I was going to bring that up later. Howard. I definitely noticed that, you know, the Videodrome influence. Another major theme of your films is the skewing of pretense, this really appeal that no one and nothing is what it seems on the surface, and that few people can really be trusted, especially not any so-called authority figures. This particularly stands out in films like Creep and Wicked Games, plus your Dirty Cop No Donut films, of course. Now, I personally totally agree with you here, as I've had much the same experience of the world and people in general, but what brings you to this conclusion? Were there any particular life experiences that taught you to read between the lines?
Oh, yeah, everyday existence, pretty much. I mean, really, if you really look at it, I mean, I think about it, there's a line of Magnum Force that comes to mind where the vigilantes have got Dirty Harry in the garage there, and they're like going, you know, you're one of us, you're a vigilante, you know, you've got to join us. And he just like looks at him and says, you know, I'm afraid you've misjudged me, but and then they go on to say further, they're like going, you know, you heroes have killed a dozen people this week, what's next? And they're like going, you know, all our heroes are dead. And that's, I think in life, a lot of it, whether it's sports people or movie people or politicians, whatever you're into, it seems to be tainted, you know, it's just,
right.
It's not what it seems. The flower is decaying before your eyes. It's so in that respect, unfortunately, it's just kind of a knee-jerk reaction to, you know what you see. And for some people, it's family or family members that weren't, that, you know, they weren't what you thought they were, or again, idols. It seems that everything is just kind of falling apart. So yeah, I guess I kind of touch on that with the characters, because you're like going, oh, that one's a good guy, and then later on, you know, they have this. It's like a graveyard in the closet. You know, it's like, oh, wow. So, yeah, I would say it's a mixture of, you know, just, you know, absorbing, you know, what's going on around you. And of course, now with the media and the internet and everything exposing everything at an alarming pace, so much that you can't even keep up with it, definitely something that probably more and more people are tapping into. It's like everything is conspiracy almost.
It's like that old thing, you know, there's nothing secret that's not going to shout it from the rooftops. We're there already.
Exactly.
So why do you think that more people out there seem to be, anyway, incapable of seeing through the clouds of officious smoke and all the social masks we wear every day to look behind the curtain and see who Oz really is, like we're talking about here? And why do you think that's more of a select group that seems to be able to say, oh, well, you know what, this might not really be what it seems to be?
That's a really good question. I wish I had an answer for it. It seems that the masses are brainwashed on a lot of issues, whether it's social, political, economical. I mean, it's outrageous, and if you really look at it, that's why so many people get really frustrated. I mean, I guess a lot of people don't want to see the lining. You know, they don't want to see.
Yeah.
So maybe they just lie to themselves and go along as a kind of a, what would you call that, like a safety valve, an escape hatch, detachment.
Yeah.
like
an ostrich.
Yeah, it's like going, you know, everything's okay. I guess it comes down to, if you lie so much, you believe it yourself, so you just got to feed yourself these lies and, you know, to keep going. And then maybe it is a good thing, because if people really saw how the bubble is bursting or has burst or however you want to look at it, you know, you might have pandemonium and people in riots.
Yeah, it could be a much darker world than everybody is.
Going insane. You know, it'd be kind of crazy, you know.
Okay, so one final thematic thing I brought up. The final theme in your film is a bit more existential, but it's about your sins catching up with you one way or another. This is all over the place in your work, but it's particularly noticeable in Creep, Reconciled, and especially your segment in Twisted Illusions 2. It was pretty amusing and somewhat true to life of the main character. It was running from town to town, panicking over who might be after all her various money scams, you know, running out with her drug dealer husband's cash, her job promotion-based affair, her blackmail schemes. But she got caught on something totally absurd and unrelated, which was, you know, not returning videos. I mean, there's also another nod to how no one can be trusted, and it turns out that she was turned in by her only friend in town. Again, just betrayed for money. Where do you pull this theme from?
Well, I guess it's the old thing. The old thing that even goes back to the thing story, the who goes here, who goes there story. You know, who can you trust? And you know, and then if you are doing things that you aren't supposed to be, or you're kind of walking that line, or if you're in life, if you're one of these people who kind of skews the truth to your advantage, then you get into this state where you've told so many lies, and you've got this huge trail of things that you got to try to cover and recover and talk about, and perhaps your own paranoia is going to catch up with you, and then you're going to get ensnarled eventually in one of the things that you've done and whoever you've screwed over. So it's kind of like a family tree of a betrayal that catches up with you. So again, it's like everybody, we've probably all seen people who do this on big and small levels, and who knows, maybe we all do this, and some of us don't even realize to what extent, and it's just kind of tapping into that and going, hey, this is kind of strange. It's, I guess self analysis would be the hardest thing, and who knows, maybe I'm looking at myself going, let me exaggerate this a little bit because I do this too. But it's kind of strange.
So let's delve into the films themselves a little bit. Tell us about Twisted Illusion. You and Joel Weinkoop self-produced, wrote, and directed this one while you were still in high school. How'd you get this one paid for and distributed?
Well, at the time, it would have been like 1984, 1985, and that was kind of the era of the mom-and-pop video stores where they were first popping up in small neighborhoods around America. And basically my own hometown, which was like Jupiter, Florida at the time, I just kind of saw a place, making Super 8 movies and then finally working with video. I was like, what are we going to do with these? It's fun to show them in school. It's fun to show them in classes. It's fun to have, showings at your house where you gather some friends and family and view these things. But, what's the next, what else can we do with them? And then, of course, being a fan of, like, H.G. Lewis and all that kind of stuff, it was the drive-ins. I'd read about,
right,
all the stuff, how, they presented these movies to the drive-ins. And I think at the same time, a lot of other people who made movies and distributed movies saw what, the potential of Beta, and then of course the Beta and VHS wars, which became VHS. So it was just seeing that if we went to the store and said, hey, we got a locally made movie, would you be interested in buying a copy to rent out? And it was just that thought, and then actually acting on that thought and going around and selling them. Then we kind of started to travel further than the local video store, the one 60 miles away, 120 miles away, 300 miles away, and then we kind of touched base with just by going into these stores with these van guys, which in van guys I mean they're like distributors of stuff to the video stores. They would sell and trade all these tapes, and then we kind of got our tapes mixed in with theirs, and they were like, they sold a few and did okay with them, so just kind of went from there. So it was kind of just being at the right time at the right place with the with the something. I don't know if it was really too good, but the market was very hungry back then for anything new, because of course at that time everything wasn't on video at all. The studios were resisting. They were like, we don't want to release this because we're not, once they rent it out, we don't get a piece of the pie. So.
Right. I think we're going back to that, actually.
It does seem to, with the streaming and everything, it is bizarre where we're at now. It's actually, the studios are looking at the streaming module. They're going, we're not making enough of this again, so we're going to restrict it and try to handle it ourselves, or charge you so much you can't afford it, which is what, Netflix is going through right now. So.
Right.
And it was pretty much going up to the clerk going, hey, I'm Tim Ritter, this is Joel Weinkoop. Or Joel would say, I'm Joel Weinkoop, this is Tim Ritter. And, we made this little movie here. What do you think of this? It's called Day of the Reaper. It's a little slasher movie. And we shot it locally. And, we see you guys rent, lots of movies. How does the horror section do? Oh, we just try to enter a conversation with them. And hopefully it's the owner. More times than not, it was just somebody they hired. They're like, you go through your whole spiel for 30 minutes. They're like, yeah, it's great and everything. We'd love to pick up a guy, but, I'm not the owner. Then you got to try to figure out, how to get to the owner and get back to. But sometimes it was the owner, and they'd be like, go on, they'd either be very receptive and go, yeah, man, how much you want for that? And be like, I think Day of the Reaper, we started out like 25, 30 bucks, something like that. Studio movies were like 60 or 80, so, but it wasn't really a top-notch box cover or anything, so.
Hello, everyone. This is Mark Polonia.
And this is Tim Ritter.
And you're listening to Third Eye Cinema.
Be there or be square. Ha ha!
Third Eye Cinema with our special guest tonight, Tim Ritter. Coming up, we discuss the difficulties in working with a big budget on his first film, Wicked Games, and the German Gore re-edit, only here on Third Eye Cinema.
Old age of 17 when you sold the script for Truth or Dare. Normally I'd ask how you accomplished manning your first nationally released outside production-based film before you even graduated high school, but I understand you came into this with a lot of chutzpah and refused to accede to any directors offered. Finally, you got the producers to agree to let you direct your own script at a very healthy budget, $250K. It was rather ambitious of you, not only selling off a script successfully at that age, but doing that kind of hard bargaining to make yourself a director, then throwing in the car chases and explosions and locations. You know, that film was not your typical, like, SOV, autorial venture, where it's very cheap and very local and very, let's film something out in the woods. I'd make a bet that others in the field, like, say, the Polonius or John McBride, for example, would die for a budget like that, particularly right out of the starting gate.
It could be. It has pros and cons. You know, it was meant to be much smaller, and what happened was, I mean, in a nutshell, the Van guys I was just talking about ended up distributing Twisted Illusions, which had a short in it called Truth or Dare, and then that got a little bit of national, you know, selling point, like New York, Chicago, you know, some of the L.A., a few markets in these other mom-and-pop video stores. And it came to the attention of VSI, Video Swap International, which was one of the biggest used tape brokers back then, and they were looking to produce you know, some direct-to-video stuff, and Truth or Dare, we kind of pitched it to them, and to make a long story short, after many plane flights and many months and working on a script and making the short movie a longer script and everything, you know, they were to the point where, you know, hey, yeah, we want to do this. So at a certain point, trying to get it financed, we were going to shoot it on, like, a Betacam just for, like, $60,000 or $50,000, you know, something low, more in the line of, you know, what Blood Cult eventually did.
Right.
But it just kind of grew from there. They got a producer involved, a couple producers who had connections in the industry, who had worked with stunt people and explosive people, and they're like going, you know, we want to make this bigger. And it just amazingly grew and grew and grew, and I was actually kind of resistant to the growing, because I knew once it got to that budget level where it was going to be, you know, $250,000, $300,000, whatever, you're going to lose a lot of control. You got a lot of chefs in the kitchen. So really, I mean, while it was like a film school training ground and one, and getting to, you know, do a project that you originated and everything, and I learned a lot, because by no means did I know, you know, everything at that point. As a matter of fact, I probably knew very little, probably even smaller than I'm even willing to admit. But, you know, I mean, I knew enough to set up shots, direct the actors, I knew what I wanted, but there's so many things to, you know, collaborations and movie making that you continue to learn as you do it. You know, you always learn something. So, you know, I was definitely, you know, wet behind the ears when doing that. So I view it more as like a film school. It was really, you know, a pretty good experience on one half, and then a pretty bad experience on the other half, because everything did get so, you know, out of control with so many people trying to do something different, and you have all this money involved, and, you know, people coming through with things, not coming through with things they said they were going to do, and it just, it made the movie, the end product was kind of a mishmash of mistakes, actually. I mean, I mean, as good as it was to start out like that, it's, you know, when you have other movies that where you have really cool people who are of the same mindset and they love the genre and everybody's collaborating and doing it because they love it, as opposed to this is a way to make money. When you have investors involved and corporations, it becomes a business, and then it really takes, I mean, of course, and it is, it takes money to do all this, but it really, unfortunately, a lot of times, it takes a lot of the fun out of it. I mean, there's very few companies that back off for anybody creative and go, you know, yeah, do whatever you want, you know, we don't care. I mean, it does happen, you read about it, but you always wonder, is that person really telling the truth, that they had $1.5 million, and the company just said, yeah, we don't care, do whatever. Do whatever you please.
Did your age have a lot of, I wouldn't want to say sway, but did people look at you, look down at you because you were so young, or was that not even a factor?
Well, they never asked how old I was when we were, you know, when everything was being put together, and by the time the contracts were assembled, I was 18, so I could actually legally enter into to these different contracts that we have. But yeah, once people found out how actually young I was, and it didn't even come till, you know, they came down to Florida to actually, you know, we pulled it all together down there because that's where it was originally set up and everything. And at some point, they did figure out that this guy just graduated high school, so there was some animosity and the usual, this group of people was on his side, this group of people was on everyone else's side.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of did play into it at a certain point.
Yeah, I was going to say, there's two main things I wanted to get out of that. Was first of all, again, how did you get the chutzpah or the balls or whatever to just go and say, you know what, I don't want to take anybody else that you're offering for a director. I want to do this. What inspired you? How did you get that kind of fortitude at that age? And secondly, did you run into any problems afterwards? Because I thought that at some point you had mentioned that you had some issues where, I don't know if they were trying to take you off the project or if they just started doing a lot of second unit work and trying to substitute that in over your footage, or I'm not sure what the exact story was at this point. Did you run into a lot of those kind of issues?
Yeah, we did run into a lot of issues. You know, the thing that inspired me at the time and still inspires me is Sylvester Stallone and the way he sold Rocky. I was reading all those kind of books, like, you know, he wouldn't sell out unless he was the star of the movie, and I was like going, you know, I got this script, I'm not going to give it up unless I'm going to be the director, and that's kind of the route that I take and took, and of course he's still at it today. I don't know if you guys like that last Rambo movie, but I was pretty blown away when I walked out of the theater going, wow. But so I would say the influence of, you know, just remaining positive and trying to just will something, you know, to happen. And sometimes it works, sometimes it doesn't. And it was, you know, it was just that case of kind of sticking with going, you know, we're not going to make this movie unless, you know, because I know how it goes. I know how this material should be told. So eventually, you know, they bought into it. So that was kind of the thinking behind that. But then, of course, you know, later, you know, there was interference. You know, when they figured out how young I was, a lot of people did have a lot of animosity. I won't say a lot of people, but a few key people involved with the production, which created conflicts, because I would set something up one way, and then they would come in and go, no, you don't want to do that. We want to set it up this way. And I'm like, going, well, you know, why is it? Because this is what I have written down. So it became, you know, kind of a war of wills, if you will, with some of the producers and some of the other people that they had hired. So by day 6 or 7 or 8, it just kind of, you know, the fun was kind of getting out of it, even changing lines. And then we had two units running simultaneously, which you have to do on a shoot for like 10 days like that, especially with, you know, all the pickup shots and all the, you know, like you mentioned before, the stunts and all that kind of stuff. So you really had to get a lot of that done at the same time. So, you know, then you had this other group of people who felt they were making the movie, and you're trying to oversee that. And then they kind of did their own thing, and it got to the point where they were getting film scenes and doing things different. And I was like, you know, I was trying to control all of it, going, you know, hey, this isn't going to work, and it's not going to connect. You're forgetting to film this scene and that scene. And then there's, you know, a few blow-ups. And by the very end of the movie, it was a case of, they were like going, you know, there's too much friction here. We've got to finish this. You know, we don't want you to be on this set anymore. And it was like the next to the last day. And of course, they forgot to film a bunch of scenes that we had mapped out. And that's that's why a lot of the things that people point out in the movie, it's like, I don't understand how this or that happened, and why the continuity is so screwed up here. And then, of course, you know, when they took the movie, and I say took, they took it back up to Chicago, where I was supposed to help them, you know, oversee editing and all that sort of thing. They kind of just did it on their own, and then some of those, amazingly, some of those, you know, gaping holes, they didn't even try to fix at all. So it was kind of disappointing, you know, at the time. At the time, I was very mad and upset about the whole thing, but, you know, at a certain point, you just let it go. And
yeah,
like,
you just got to let it go.
I view it as I'm like, you know, you got a movie out there with your name on it, and it had a, you know, a larger budget. You just make the best of it. And I did learn a lot from, you know, all of it. And of course, the legalities, the setting up of a limited partnership, the contract, you know, all that stuff. I mean, especially the business end of it. Stuff that even a no budget movie maker has to, you know, do, you know, kind of to cover bases and everything. I mean, that's, unfortunately, there is a business side to it, even if you only have a $300 budget, you know.
I was going to say, it was probably a fantastic learning experience for, you know, just all the things that could go wrong right out of the gate. And, you know, a lot of people just don't realize it. You tend to think that it's a wholly, you know, director-owned creative medium, and it's really not. It's a collaborative medium more than almost anything else except perhaps music. When you make a film, there's a lot of people involved, and, you know, it could get pulled in a lot of different directions that were not anyone's intention. It's just, okay, well, this guy wanted that, this guy wanted something else, and somehow it went over here to the left somewhere.
Exactly. It is. People don't realize how much, you know, I mean, a director, what is the definition of a director? I mean, a lot of people are like, well, you know, Hitchcock, Spielberg, they were masters. But you have to understand there are so many other creative elements that went into everything that they do, which is, you know, from your props and your storyboards and the music composer and your actor's interpretation. Did you let them improvise? So really, a director does not, you know, it's not, I mean, I don't know how some people view it, but a lot of people think that a director is just like they act out every scene and they're intensely trying to, you know, puppeteer every prop and every person. It's not like that at all. You just kind of keep everything on track and try to get the best out of everyone, and if they have a good idea, you're an idiot not to utilize that good idea. You know, if they're like, hey, I think this could be better, you're like going, yeah, you just kind of oversee it and make sure that the best ideas are used, you know. So that's pretty much what a director does, you know.
By comparison with others in the field, you've put out a respectably healthy body of work. You've helmed 14 films since 1984, four of them, of course, being Truth or Dare movies, two Twisted Illusions anthologies, two Alien Conspiracy anthologies, two Bad Cop No Donut films, and a few one-offs. How have you managed to stay afloat and motivated over all these years where many of your contemporaries in the silent video field have just fallen by the wayside after only a few films over a much shorter period of time?
I don't know. Either sheer stupidity, insanity, or I guess it's just the case that if you know, I've tried to like slow down, and I have slowed down a little bit on occasion or taking a break or whatever, but you know, it just becomes you know, you're just driven, you just don't feel alive unless you're creating stuff. So it's something that, you know, if you stop doing it, you just don't feel, you feel like you know, cut off one of your arms or something. You're like going, you know, things just aren't the same unless I'm working on you know, a project. So I mean, maybe a lot of people are able to, you know, kind of morph into something else where they're actually being creative and get paid for it, and you know, that's why they're able to you know, do stuff. I've had offers to do, and I have worked in the industry as far as, you know, doing stuff for other people. In other words, okay, you're assigned to, you know, do something. And for me, it was just not the same, where it was like, you know, even if it's writing, it's like, you know, you need to write about these subjects. It just wasn't the same. Even doing, like, productions, I've done, you know, industrial stuff and videos for bands. And sometimes those can be fun if you're into the music and everything. But if your heart and your passion isn't into the material that you're doing, it just becomes like any other job. You might as well flipping hamburgers somewhere or washing dishes or whatever. You know, you're like, oh yeah, this is real fun.
There's an interesting credit on Wicked Games where you note that it's produced in conjunction with the Palm Beach Shakespeare Festival. What was the derivation of this? Did you use a number of like summer stock actors in this one? Some of the ladies in this are rather attractive, and there's some nice lingerie on display there. So it'd be amusing if they came from the crowd that's usually putting on like King Lear or what have you.
Yeah, absolutely. It was actually the producer, Kermit Chrisman, I think he still oversees the Palm Beach Shakespeare Festival down in Florida, and they do, and it's like, I think West Palm Beach, North Palm Beach, they do several, two or three plays a year, and the lead actor in Wicked Games that co-starred with Joel Weinkoop, Kevin Scott Crawford, I think he's taking a more active role in, you know, that whole thing down there. But yeah, it turned out that I was working at a video store, and Kermit used to come in and rent videos all the time, and at that time, Killing Spree came out, and I was like, yeah, I made this movie. And he was like, well, we've got to collect. And he had, like, this Shakespeare accent that he always put on as the director of the show, and he'd be like, well, yes, we must collaborate at some point. And you know, and we ended up, you know, doing Wicked Games together. And the big thing that he had that was, you know, very cool as a producer is access to, you know, a lot of different talent, actors, actresses, and locations. Those are some of the, you know, as a small movie maker, anybody who's tried it knows those are two big things that if you can get somebody to help you out on those, you're way ahead of the game, because when you try to do it yourself, it can become a nightmare. So it's kind of interesting, you know, in the casting process, he had access to all these, you know, really cool people that were not afraid of doing anything, and they were used to doing, you know, Shakespeare and Edgar Allan Poe and, you know, all these things in the park where they were
right.
Doing it live. So, you know, it was really kind of awesome to have, you know, these actors who were so professional involved with the movie. So
what's this you mentioned on your site about an ultimate re-edit of this one, too? Sort of a German gore film, like Andres Schnaas. I think you called it Wicked Game Snuff. There was a slight parallel to Schnaas's Violent Shit series in there with the Copper Mask shared by Mike Strauber and Carl the Butcher, that overdub reverb, kind of like death metal chant of die every time one of the mic analogs kill someone. So I can sort of understand them making that connection. But, you know, if memory serves, the Schnaas films are like a completely different animal. I don't really classify them with the strain of SOV cinema that your films are more associated with. He's more like one of those backyard coppolas like the Todd Sheets or Jim Van Babber, one of those ultra gore fetishists. So how did this come about?
Well, when we did Wicked Games originally back in 92 and 93, somewhere in there, it came out the way that I thought it should, but then there were some things that I wish I could have done, and we ended up shooting so much footage. I almost shot the movie twice due to equipment problems. We actually shot it in high 8, and that was kind of when high 8 was coming out. It was very experimental, the whole format, and we had so much footage. And what happened was in like 2002 or 3, we got the opportunity because our movies did really, really good in Germany,
right.
Especially like Creep, Killing Spree, and Wicked Games. We had, you know, some really decent sales there, and they were really, you know, popular movies. So some guys approached me and said, hey, you know, we'd like to do, you know, another release of Wicked Games. We've read that, you know, you shot the movie twice, and not all of the footage was used, and they didn't even realize the extent of how much was left. So they were like, going, we'd like to put something together and restructure the entire movie. And I started to think about it, and we started to, you know, throw ideas back and forth. And then we had some other filmmakers contribute some crazy subliminal. I don't know if you've seen the movie, but it's really strange. It's kind of like.
Has it been released yet?
Only in Germany, actually. You can get somewhere. Yeah. Sometimes you can get it in VHS on the Sub Rosa site. They had it briefly there, but I'm hoping that eventually they'll put it out on like a, you know, Truth or Dare box set. But we kind of took it like you know, the movie Memento or something like that, Irreversible, where we started at the end and worked our way back to the beginning, sort of. And we used a lot of alternate takes. Different takes, double takes.
Right.
They had a lot of subliminal stuff in there and really amped up the gore. We used longer shots of all the gore, different takes, longer takes, and it was, you know, it was kind of cool the way it came out. Different music score.
Right.
I thought it worked out. Some people don't like it. I actually kind of like it better than the original cut because it's more,
really?
And it doesn't have that ending where it was all a dream, and it's got a different ending where it turns out that it's all, you know, basically the three murderers look at each other, and then they all decide that they're guilty, so they just kind of walk away and go, okay, well, it's kind of a standoff here. You don't tell on me, I won't tell on you, so...
Right. That's actually where I thought the film was going to end.
Right. Like I said, this was... Kermit Chrisman really wanted to go with that ending. He was really kind of high on the movie Kafka at the time. Kafka-esque, kept saying, let's do this Kafka-esque thing. It took forever to figure out that ending, and it still didn't make much sense to me on the original Wicked Games cut, where Mike Strauber saw his doctors and this nurse as all these different characters, like we were talking about earlier, in his head and in his mind. It was, you know, all these other things were happening, and then you come out of it at the end. But it's kind of the old, the whole movie was just a dream, and that kind of ticked off a lot of viewers at the time.
Well, I think
it's all a dream.
You know, it fits right into your thematic, strain throughout your film. So it didn't bother me, but I was surprised at that. I'll say that. But
do you think
the German connection was really just that they're sitting there saying, "Oh, look, you know, Mike Strauber wears a copper mask and says die, and here's Carl the Butcher, and he wears a copper mask and says die." And,
oh, really? See, I haven't seen those in a long time. I don't know. I don't know if I've ever seen them all in their entirety or not. But yeah, I don't.
It's been a long time.
Yeah, I'm not sure if there's that connection or. If they, yeah, maybe it was, you know, I know they, you know, were happy the way it did in the video market when they put it out there, so.
Hey, this is Tim Ritter, and you're listening to Third Eye Cinema, home of underground filmmakers and artists, so take a listen. It's well worth your time.
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema with a special guest tonight, Tim Ritter. Coming up, we discuss Joel Weinkoop, Asbestos Felt, and the prostitution scandal star from Creep, only here on Third Eye Cinema.
Let's spend a few minutes on the anthologies, the alien conspiracy films and the Twisted Illusion films. How did those come about? Were they originated by you and formed out to collaborations with other directors, or did someone else draft you for your sequences in these? And who was John Bowker who got involved in Twisted Illusions too?
Okay, well, the Alien Agenda movies are actually produced by Kevin Lindemuth, who did Addicted to Murder and a bunch of other movies. He's the one who kind of initiated the idea. He had the kind of the science fiction trilogy, and I think it ended up being 6 movies altogether, you know, to do that, and to get other filmmakers to do, like, 30-minute pieces that fit into his movie and put them all together. So he kind of came to me and said, hey, you want to contribute to this, along with a few other filmmakers at the time, and he also contributed segments himself and oversaw the editing of the entire thing, as far as once we put our segment together, he would integrate it and then make sure that it fit in to his big picture of everything. So he's the one who kind of initiated those. And John Bowker is just another friend of mine who also makes shot-on-video movies, and he's done a bunch of them. Like he did them on his own before I ever met him. He did one called The Seekers, and I know we did one together called Housebound. But he ended up contributing to I think one of the Alien Conspiracy projects, and then we ended up then I kind of hooked him up because he wanted to continue making, shot-on-video movies, and I hooked him up with Sub Rosa Studios. At the time, I was executive producing a bunch of movies for them, and I got a couple of his projects going with them. Let's see, it was The Seekers and Housebound and Evil Maker. He did, like, a couple movies called The Evil Maker. He's based out of Oregon, and he's still, making shot-on-video movies. He just finished one called, I think, Platoon of the Living Dead for J.R. Bookwalter. And then the Alien Conspiracy and Alien Agenda movies were, definitely Kevin Lindemuth. He put them, basically, he just came to us and said, what I want to do is I want to, integrate this alien invasion, this subtle alien invasion idea with this war between the Greys and the Morphs into the mix here. You can do pretty much everything, anything that you want as long as it fits in there. So the original one was kind of a homage to Escape from New York, where Joel Weinkoop plays this Snake Plissken type character who has to go through kind of a ravaged apocalyptic Florida, and we kind of just frame things and use all kinds of Everglades areas and burned out buildings and dilapidated areas to make it look like that. It was actually a lot of fun to do, and there's no restrictions other than I did a draft of the script that I wanted to do, and then Kevin went in and put in things that fit to the T for his big picture of the whole thing. And, it worked out pretty well. So the original trilogy was pretty well received. The second trilogy kind of came out late in the shot-on-video distribution era, so it wasn't received as well, and we didn't have as much money to do any of the segments, so it wasn't as well received.
But the Twisted Illusions were more yours and Joel Weinkoop, so I guess you had just dragged in John Bowker for two, just because you knew him, you wanted to give him some extra time.
When we did Twisted Illusions 2, we were like thinking, okay, we need if we get three different filmmakers to each film a 30-minute segment, we'll have a 90-minute movie. So, and John was really cranking stuff out at the time and did a good job. So I was like going, okay, Joel does one, John does one, and I'll do one. And we got it made. So that was pretty much how we looked at it. He came through with a pretty cool zombie movie.
Well, you haven't quite built a repertory cast like the Polonius. You've had some recurring cast members, most or all of whom worked on more than one function on set. Like Joel Weinkoop, for example, he's been a frequent star. He's done some writing for you. He's co-directed with you. He's done props and stunts. He's choreographed some fighting sequences. He's even produced some of your films. He really seems to have stuck with you for several years and was involved in various aspects of many of your films. Tell us a little bit about him and your relationship there. How did you get involved with him?
Well, actually, Joel and I, were friends, way back in the day, as in he was a babysitter. He was my babysitter when I was a little kid from across the street. And he was out there cranking out little Super 8 movies, and that was the same time that I was getting obsessed with dinosaurs, movie making, comic books, and Incredible Melting Man and King Kong and all that sort of stuff. So I was actually in some of his early Super 8 movies. And then he moved away from our neighborhood, and then kind of like you guys getting back together again, but this was like a less time span. This was like maybe 5 or 6 years later, but I was just finished Day of the Reaper, and his nephew was in the same school that I was in. And he was like, hey, he went to his uncle and said, hey, do you know this guy? He just got this movie in the school. school newspaper called Day of the Reaper. And Joel immediately called me up, and I was like, oh, yeah, I'm trying to do this. And he helped start to sell Day of the Reaper, and he was like, you know, I want to be an actor, so I want to get in the next movie. And then Twisted Illusions became the big collaboration where we both, you know, did, you know, what we wanted to do at the time. And of course, he wanted to got in a little bit of the writing and directing, and you know, had a blast as an actor. He tried to jump in on every role. As a matter of fact, I was like, well, no,
yeah.
We should get another actor for that. He's like, no, let me play that role. And I was like, well, no. We got to get some more actors in here. So it just kind of grew from there, and we both kind of had the same goals. But his main goal was, you know, becoming an actor and getting, you know, notoriety doing that. So we kind of just split things up as we did each movie, trying to kind of make it in the business. But he was always very cool, and we were always good friends. And, you know, we'd all, when we could, take our regular day job paychecks and go, okay, how much do you got left after the bills? Well, can the bills wait one more week? We got to pay this actress. We got to pay Kathy Willis from Creep. We got to do this. We got to do that. So it became, you know, kind of just like an obsessive thing where we were both like going, you know, one movie after another to keep the, you know, momentum going. And then any money we made off any projects, we would just kind of put it in the next movie. And of course, it was never enough to complete it.
Right.
You have to be, you know, putting more money in there. But Joel did really well. You know, actually, even when I moved away from Florida, he continued down there in Tampa. And of course, he just starred in, ironically, he ended up in a lead role in Herschel Gordon Lewis's latest movie, The Uh-Oh.
Oh, really?
So it's pretty cool. So he's still at it, and he's gone. And I forget what the budget was on that. It might have been close to $750,000 or something. So, you know, he really, you know, has continued to you know, do what he loves. And amazingly, he transcended out of our movies and our collaborations into, you know, all these other movies. I think Kevin Lindemuth asking me to do segments in Alien Agenda, he specifically requested that Joel be in it. And that was kind of the beginning of filmmakers going, hey, this Joel Weinkoop guy is cool and passionate, and, you know, he's affordable, and let's use him in a movie. And that, and then another filmmaker, Marcus Koch, I guess he was out of Tampa. That's how Joel got involved with that. He did his movie Rot, which ended up on the EI label. And then in Tampa, there's kind of like a thriving industry there. So he, you know, I think he was in Brain Robbers from Outer Space. And then from there, it was just, you know, it's been one project after another for him.
Yeah, I mean, I was really surprised that not only is he doing the acting, but he's getting involved in producing. And then he was doing things like stunts and choreographing fight sequences and karate scenes. I'm like, whoa, what's the story here?
Right. Well, he's always been a Chuck Norris fan. So, you know, when we did Truth or Dare, he jumped in, you know, I got him involved, and unfortunately he lost the lead role. So then we were able to hook him up with the stunt team and, you know, doing some of the Mike Straber role and everything. So that's where he kind of got like the same experience that I did, the kind of with Truth or Dare. It was like kind of like, okay, now we're actually really making movies and being paid for it, and we got a budget here. And he kind of learned everything by doing a project, you know, that he helped initiate. So it was kind of cool.
Right.
You feel like you guys kind of kept each other motivated over the early years?
Oh, yeah. Oh, definitely. Yeah, because there's definitely times, you know, as you guys know, being creative and everything, it's just, you know, there's times where you're like, oh, man, I got to throw in the white flag this week. And then
yeah.
The other person's like, oh, no, we can't do that. Or the other person says the same thing. I mean, we had many conversations, many nights for hours where it'd be like, going, man, job's killing me, life's killing me, it's just time to give up. And we'd have this, you know, big pity party conversation. We're like going, we're done with this. Okay. What time are we going to be on the set tomorrow? 8 a.m.? Yeah. Okay.
Really, you really need that other person to give you the motivation.
Definitely.
I actually used to be a fairly serious, you know, small-time weightlifter back when, you know, again, back in, like, the early 90s. And once I lost my partner, who was basically the motivation, like, okay, every time you'd see him, if you dropped off, he got bigger. And I was like, wait a minute, let me do that. And ever since I stopped hanging around with him, that was it. So I know exactly what you're talking about. You do need somebody else that's in the same field that's giving you this kind of, like, well, come on, what are you doing? Let's get up. Like, you know, when you're feeling like, okay, I'm just, that's it, I'm done, I dropped out.
Right. You're asking yourself, why am I even doing this?
So tell us about Asbestos Felt, who had cameo roles in Truth or Dare and Creep, and had quite a memorable starting turn in Killing Spree. He's quite an interesting character on screen, and I understand that's actually his legal name.
I it might be. It might be. Maybe he did change his name. That's all I've ever known him as is pretty much Asbestos Felt, and I believe he signed all his contracts like that and everything. And he's got a story behind that. He was he was a friend of producer Al Nicolosi, who worked with us, me and Joel, on Twisted Illusions, and then was a producer of Killing Spree. And he was like, they worked at Master Control at ABC TV affiliate down in Florida, and Asbestos worked with him. So that's where I first met him. He was like, you got to meet this guy. He's outrageous, man. And when I first met him, I mean, he's pretty much what you see on screen a lot. I mean, he's just full of energy and zaniness, and you just don't know what he's going to come up with next. So I was like, well, man, this guy's wild. We definitely got it. And he's always got, you know, crazy comments for everything, which is, you know, really cool for improv and all that kind of stuff. So upon meeting him, we know we cast him, and of course, Truth or Dare is the hand grenade guy in the hallucination where he puts the grenade in his mouth and blows up his head. And, you know, then we ended up kind of tailoring Killing Spree for him. So it was a pretty intense experience. In order to get him to stay, you know, and to make sure that he just didn't wander off, because, I mean, he would be like, you know, I got other ventures going. You know, we had definitely, his big payment was scotch at the house. I mean, that was what got him to stay there, because we were both worried that it'd just be like, you know, he'd lose interest and go, you know, I got other things to do other than this. And Killing Spree was a fairly large budget, because we shot it on 16mm and raised like $50,000-$75,000 to go do it. So I was like, you know, there's a lot of money on here, there's investors, and they're all going to be looking at us, and, you know, we got to make sure we finish this thing properly. But yeah, he was a blast to work with, and you just, like I said, you just never knew. I vividly remember he was so intoxicated during before the scene with the hammer, where he's standing on the ladder and he was like in bed and he was like barely coherent. I was like, going, Asbestos, let's go over these lines. He's like, okay, he could barely even speak a sentence clearly at all. And I was like, oh man. But you know what, 5 minutes later, when I was like, okay, Asbestos, we got the ladder ready, are you going to be all right to even climb up? He was like, I mean, he was dead on. It was like suddenly this adrenaline surged through his body, and he did not make one mistake. And I was amazed. I was like, going, was he just acting like he was drunk? Or was it? But when it came, you know, time to do a shot, he never, ever blew it, even with, you know, his mark. He never got his mark wrong or anything. So
he was really something else. Killing Spree was actually my first film of yours that I saw, and I was just like, my mouth dropped. So that's what actually got me into following up. Okay, let me find another film this week. Talk to us about Patricia Paul. You showcased her twice in Wicked Games as the rather attractive S&M aficionado Ginger, and again in Creep as Jackie, the rule-breaking cop with a troubled family history. I think, if I'm not mistaken, she was the only female to appear in more than one of your movies, and these are quite different roles. Apparently after this, she did one more TV role and just vanished. Where did you find her? Did you know what the story was there with her?
Oh, yeah, she was part of the Palm Beach Shakespeare group for Wicked Games. So she came from, you know, Kermit Crispin's group. And, man, she was just, on Wicked Games, just excellent to work with. She had ideas. She contributed, wasn't afraid to do anything. And, you know, she really had a great acting ability. And you know, from that, when we started planning Creep, when that came, you know, the next project came up, and I kind of specifically wrote a role for her in mind. It was completely the opposite of, you know, of course, Wicked Games, where she's like the damsel in distress and all that kind of thing. So in Creep, it was kind of like, okay, here's your homework. You got to watch all these Dirty Harry movies because you're playing, you know, Dirty Harriet, pretty much.
Right.
So, and she was really cool with that, and, you know, she did a really good job in the movie and everything. And I don't know what happened to her, you know, post-Creep. I guess, again, you know, like we talked about, sometimes if you don't have, you know, a motivating, you know, person, or there's not projects where, you know, people, you know, get behind you and go, hey, yeah, let's keep doing this. She just seemed to kind of, you know, lose interest, and I guess some things in life, you know, took her in a different direction. So, you know, it wasn't anything, you know, that, in other words, I really don't know, you know, it's just, I know she was married to, and I don't know if she still is, a race car driver, a well-known one.
Really?
I don't follow that. Yeah, I don't remember who it was, but I know he was on different, you know, cans, pop cans. So, and everybody was always impressed with that. So, you know, maybe, you know, I know she had just had a child, so she, you know, obviously probably had a lot of things to do with raising the family and everything. But she was really cool to work with, and, you know, I thought she did, you know, a really good job in, you know, in both movies.
What was the genesis of Creep? I mean, it fits right in thematically with most of your film repertoire, but there's an unusually strong emphasis during this period, you know, Wicked Games, Creep, on sex. I mean, in this particular case, you threw in everything with the kitchen sink. I mean, you've got incest and murder. I mean, it's just really over the top. Where did this all come from at that time?
Well, I guess part of it, you know, is just, you know, when you're a horror fan, as we all are, you get,
right.
There's so many different subgenres and little niches in the marketplace, and you become obsessed with, you know, whether it's Asian movies or serial killer movies or whatever. And I've always kind of gravitated to the, you know, the various slasher movies. And at
right.
that time, I discovered the works of Jack Ketchum somewhere in that neighborhood, 92, 93, 94, and, you know, when we made that. So a lot of his writing, I was like going, wow, this is real. And, of course, his movies, his books have now been, you know, adapted into, you know, bunches of different movies. In the last 5 or 6 years, finally. So I was, like, you know, very inspired by his work of, you know, finding, you know, killers. And, again, the whole thing of somebody who seems to be normal who ends up not being normal at all. So, you know, he ends up actually being some kind of psychopath or something. So that kind of all played into that. And also studying, of course, serial killers. And pretty big around that time was Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer. Finally, it was, you know, it took 4 years to finally come out and finally hit video. And that was a very influential movie, so she kind of had that flavor influence into the whole thing, and it was just kind of a mixed mash of everything. The original script, though, evolved with just, it was very different, it was much darker, it was the first draft of the script was much more like, I forget the name of the movie, but somebody did one with murder set pieces, I believe. I ended up, that was very close. The original creep script project was very close to that, with just this dead serious murderer and then the cop. And then he ends up, actually, originally he ended up kidnapping the cop, and there was just kind of a, you know, war between those two in his lair, so to speak. But then when Kathy Willits came involved, she kind of, I guess I did an interview with Herschel Gordon Lewis and did something in the Fort Lauderdale Sun Sentinel, and Kathy Willits had just started some kind of PR campaign based on something, and she saw, you know, an article on me and figured she wanted to try to do, you know, a couple of different things in the entertainment industry. One, which would be, you know, kind of regular movies, and give that a shot, regular acting, as opposed to adult acting and that kind of thing. So out of the blue, she was like, hey, actually she had her husband call under a different name, and we went round and round. He's like, how would you like to have a real celebrity in one of your movies? And I was like, I thought it was a joke. I was like thinking, oh,
right.
Yeah, okay. Then eventually he finally revealed, no, it's Kathy Willits. And I, you know, I don't really keep track of, you know, a lot of, you know, the scandalous celebrities. And back then, of course, the internet wasn't there or anything, so if you hadn't
right.
seen it on TV. But she'd been on Geraldo and Current Affair and, you know, all these different shows. And I ran her name past a few people, and they were like going, yeah, you got to use her. It's just great. So I was like thinking, well, you know, Cronenberg used Marilyn Chambers in Rabid, so, you know what would it hurt? So then I took the original script that I'd written specifically for Patricia Paul in the cop role, and then Joel was going to play the killer, and then I just kind of integrated a third character to try to get, you know, Kathy Willits a kind of a cool role. And I basically kind of put her in her own situation, kind of where she was just kind of a, not a serial killer, of course, but just kind of a...
Right.
Somebody in the adult entertainment industry, and she dealt with all kinds of different situations that were kind of ripped out of the headlines, and then her brother came in and kind of tried to defend her and all that kind of stuff. So it kind of worked out well, and a lot of people think she did terrible, but I'm like, if I look back, you know, at the footage now, I'm like going, hey, she did, you know, she did pretty decent, you know. It's not Academy Award winning, you know, performance, but then is anything in these little movies?
Right. Exactly. What was this tag? I'd actually never heard of her. You had her listed as America's favorite nymphomaniac.
Right. It was a huge scandal in, I guess, Miami-Dade back in, the 89 or 90 or something like that. But it turned out what it was basically in a nutshell is, I mean, it's kind of hard to describe. She became a prostitute with her husband's blessing, and he would hide in the closet and videotape her. And then politicians got involved, were clients of hers. I think the mayor or something, some other people that were, you know, pretty big in the Dade Broward functioning government. So when she was finally busted, he had all these videotapes of her with all these, you know, politicians. So it became...
Mm-hmm.
One of those first, you know, scandalous cases. You know, what are we going to do with her? Are we going
right.
to prosecute these guys? And she got, you know, tons of notoriety from it, especially in South Florida. It was, you know, mainly prevalent in South Florida. But then once she went through all the court things and all that stuff, and then she tried to kind of make a career out of it on the, I guess, stripper circuit she did, and then I guess she did some adult films, and but she did like magazine spreads, and you know, took it to a national level, so a lot of people you know, that like that sort of thing, I guess, were familiar with her. So
you're listening to Third Eye Cinema with our special guest tonight, Tim Ritter. Coming up, we discuss Creep, Reconcile with the Christ, and Serial Killer Culture. Only here on Third Eye Cinema.
And you're listening to Third Eye Cinema, one of the homes for highbrow interview entertainment.
There's an extremely dark and cynical feel in this movie, like you touched on, but even more so than your other films. You know, literally everyone here is guilty in one way or another, caught up in one perversion or another, and pretty much headed for self-destruction. The parallels between Patricia Paul's character and the revelations about her father and childhood, and Joel's character and the revelations about his mother and childhood, are quite interesting. What's being said, that someone driven to be a cop may be a little better or different than someone driven to be a violent criminal or a serial killer. So, again, where did this come from? You know, what was the genesis of this?
Just looking at the headlines, extreme, just the whole Kathy Willis thing I just described, you know, politicians that turn out to be corrupt, you know, everything in society being corrupt. I think this was at the time of the O.J. Simpson. I remember that being on the television. When I was writing this, it's just celebrities not seeming who they, you know, having these crazy impulses and skeletons in the closet and, you know, all these sort of things. So, and of course, you know, the material like Henry, Portrait of a Serial Killer, where it was really, you know, of course, that's a movie that it kind of really changed the genre a lot, because he, you know, the character that Michael Rooker played was so different from, in some ways, from the kind of the Joe Spinell maniac, where he's just like, you know, this crazy, you know, obviously crazy person, except for when he's on the dinner conversations with Carolyn Monroe, of course, but that's probably a whole other show. How that all merges together. But Henry was just such a normal guy who could just blend in, you know, in the movie and probably in real life, he just would blend in with everybody. Yet he had this horrific murderous hobby, you know, in the background there that he you know, had these impulses to do. So I guess it was just kind of taking every character and hence the title Creep. Every single person in the movie turns out to be a creep, and that's part of the problem with the movie, is there's really no hero to kind of identify with. You just at the very
not even close,
end. Yeah, you're just like going, oh man, and then you know, the one girl that you thought might have been normal ends up killing herself.
Right.
Like, oh, she's strapped in bombs and dynamite here. That's great.
Talk to me about Reconcile Through the Christ. This one really seems to be a huge shift in the left field from the guy who gave us the Truth or Dare films, Creep, and Killing Spree. How did this one come about?
It's just the case of, I mean, I guess when you work in independent movies and do-it-yourself stuff, at a certain point you're going to tackle, you know, religion and your religious beliefs. There's always a lot of, you know, movie makers, especially in horror, and they really have a lot of anti-religious movies. If they're an atheist,
right,
and you know, they believe, you know, they don't believe in anything or something else, they're very quick to go ahead and go out and make a movie, you know, about this subject. And at the time, I was like thinking, well, what do I believe? And I kind of rekindled my faith in Christianity a little bit and came through with that and thought about it. And I was like, well, how does this, you know, how could I make a movie about this kind of experience and also keep it in kind of, you know, in line with, you know, the stuff that I do. So an exploitation movie with a Christian overtone is sort of what Reconcile became, and kind of how it all went out. I was like just thinking, well, you know, how would you explain a story like this to somebody and kind of integrate it into a movie with a message that hopefully isn't such a big message that it pounds, you know, somebody over the head with it. And, you know, like I said, I don't know, you know, if it succeeded, but what I tried to do is take the whole story about the subject matter of, you know, what your beliefs are and everything, and then, you know, write the whole story around that, so hopefully it wasn't too preachy, even though at the same time it is like kind of going to a church service or Sunday school or something.
Yeah, I mean, it really did a number on me. You've actually kind of, you can even see from my Facebook post, I've kind of changed my direction a little bit after seeing that film. It really knocked me for a loop. I find this film utterly fascinating. If I really can't picture who the intended audience for this should be outside of, you know, outliers like myself that are really like sort of falling outside the normal sort of organized religion sort of milieu, it's hardly likely to be embraced, like I said to you when we spoke in the past, by the typical Bible study youth group or what have you. It's really rather powerful, and it did shake me up in some parts. You may actually be one of the few artists out there that are keeping up the actual ministry of Jesus, as it were, reaching out to those people who are way outside the mainstream church-going public and those who probably wouldn't be caught dead inside a Sunday service. And you even answered a few strong arguments that I have against organized religion in there. What's really unique about this film is that, as I mentioned before, it very much is a Tim Ritter film. I mean, there's sex and murder and that gritty, seedy realism that's partly inherent to SOB cinema, but also very much particular to your films, you know, as a whole. But at the same time, there's a strong didactic element to it, like a Steve Ditko comic around the time he got into Ayn Rand. Was this inspired by, I'd say, like studying one of those Christian apologists like Francis Schaeffer or C.S. Lewis or Taylor Caldwell, or did this just come organically from, you know, your reexamining your beliefs? You know, how did this really originate?
Definitely from, you know, definitely reading again, like I said before, you know, like with Creep, I was reading a lot about serial killers and Jack Ketchum and Stephen King, but definitely C.S. Lewis and, you know, a lot of the apologists were definitely an influence on, you know, the way Reconciled came about. And I was just trying to figure out how to, you know, tell the story with the way I tell stories and, like I said, not make it seem like it was something that you wouldn't want to watch. And you know, like you said, the intended audience, when it came out, it did well, especially in like the rental markets and Netflix and that sort of thing. I got probably more feedback from any movie that I've ever made, you know, prior, except for maybe Truth or Dare and Killing Spree. So when it originally was released, there was just a huge response. And then eventually, about over the course of a year, it was like, well, it kind of disappeared. So you're like, it doesn't have the, and not to say that it won't, you know, kind of rematerialize, because people, you know, different movies can, you know, they disappear for a while and come back. But it doesn't seem to have the same, you know, longevity or legs that, you know, a lot of shot on video projects have, because of the subject matter. And you're definitely right. I don't know. Again, it was just a very personal project that, you know, I wanted to just say. A lot of people, you know, they make a movie about their religious beliefs, and that's pretty much what I did with this. And I just thought it would be a good time to do something original and, you know, put that out there so people saw that there was kind of a different side of, you know, of my thinking. That I'm not. A lot of people think when, you know, if they see, you know, judge you based on one particular aspect of your work or life or whatever, they're going, that guy's got to be, like, living in a cave and planning with meat hooks around all the, you know, the cave, planning how to kill somebody or something, that, you know, you have no other, you know, beliefs or interests or anything. So just kind of wanted to, you know, put a project to get together to show that, you know, there was a different part of me, actually. So
yeah, I mean, what makes this film doubly fascinating is that in the end of the movie, at least half of what you see never actually happened. It was all in the lead character's head again, which is a typically Tim Ritter touch.
yeah, but couldn't get away from that, right?
Right. I mean, it's definitely one of your films. Anybody that's seen any of your films that isn't, you know, vehemently, you know, anti-religious, I would highly recommend them checking out this film, because it is not what you expect. I was really kind of knocked for a loop. When I saw the title, I'm like, ah, geez. But I heard some positive reviews. I was getting into all your stuff. I'm like, let me give it a shot. And you really, it was a real kick in the teeth. I got to tell you that.
Cool. I mean, it's good that, you know, people, you have to kind of keep an open mind with it and then kind of roll with it. I mean, I know a lot of people, you know, the minute you start mentioning Jesus and other things, you know, they're going to, like, be ready to turn it off and go. But if you
go
with the plot.
I was in the same boat, and that's why I'm saying this is really, it was really, I don't want to say a life changer, but you really kind of, you know, made me reexamine my perspectives on things. So it was something else. Tell us about some of the guys who were involved in this movie. As, you know, some of them are also involved in Twisted Illusions 2 or Truth or Dare 4 or both. Richard Vanaski and his wife, I think it's Tyena, and I'm assuming it's his daughter, Risa. He was in Reconciled and in both It and Twisted Illusions 2. He did casting. He was a producer. He did some cinematography and second unit directing. Tell us about him.
He's a fan who became a filmmaker. Again, kind of one of the guys that wanted to join the party and was kind of influenced by, you know, Ronnie Sorter, who did, what was it, Ravage, and, you know, some of the early shot-on-video movies, and then, of course, Wicked Games. And he just kind of joined the party before I left Florida. He's based out of Tampa down the, in, you know, in the area where Joel is in. And before I left Florida, he contacted me and was just starting one of his first movies, I Am Vengeance. And, you know, we just kind of developed a friendship based on creative stuff. And for the movies that I've done up in Kentucky, he's kind of, you know, filmed second unit stuff and directed it himself down there in Florida and sent the footage to us, and we would kind of integrate it into, like for Reconcile, he did a lot of the flashbacks of the crucifixion and that kind of
right.
thing. And even Deadly Dares, he did a lot of the Truth or Dare flashbacks when the one good character's telling the story of the killer, you know, Richard.
Right.
He actually, he did like a little remake of the original Truth or Dare and contributed. He's just a very passionate, cool, independent movie maker down there in Florida. And again, kind of like we said before, when you're doing projects with collaborations, if you meet like-minded people, it's just so much more easier and fun and exciting
yeah.
to you know, collaborate in that manner. So
now, Larry Joe Treadway, who starred in and co-produced both Reconcile and Twist Illusions too. First off, what's with the billing as Professor Tread? He was quite a memorable presence. When he first showed up in the movie, I really thought he was supposed to be Satan. And then,
oh, really?
And he kept talking. Yeah. And then as he kept talking, I figured out he must be some kind of like street-level angel or something. You know, when he finally got to who he really was, that really took him by surprise at the end. And, you know,
right.
he really had that sort of cool thing down, you know, with the piercings, the Van Dyke, the leather cowboy hats. You know, I wish my concerts was as cool as that. I always find mine to be kind of annoying. What was the story with him?
Professor Tread, he used to, and it's now, I don't know if it's defunct or they just haven't done it for a while, but he's kind of like you guys, where he had a blog and an internet TV show, and it was called Brains on Film, and he and his partners would, you know, do all this stuff for horror movies, and they were pretty regular at the convention circuit and everything, and he kind of got out of the deal there for the last couple of years, but that was his, like, stage mana was Professor Tread, so, and he was just very much into horror movies, and again, just somebody very laid back and cool to collaborate with, and he brought the stuff like the cowboy hat to the role and everything, and yeah, we discussed his delivery. He was going to do it kind of like a, you know, like a southern preacher at first, and I said, well, let's try it a different way first. Let's just try it kind of like you're talking to me now, because I think it would be, you know, you might really alienate the audience if we try
yeah.
to make it like a traditional sermon or something, or a hellfire and brimstone sermon. So, you know, I think the laid-back approach, which was pretty much an extension of you know, who he is, it really did work. So, and he was just...
Yeah, now you've definitely picked the right track there, because I actually think that it was the fact that guy was the one who was speaking all the didactic parts to the film that kept me paying attention. It wasn't like, you know, some guy in a robe coming down acting all prissy or whatever, because I would have tuned right out.
Exactly, and that's just the way Larry, you know, Larry, the real name is Larry Treadway, you know, it's the way the professor is there. Very cool.
And there really was a lot of black humor in this film, too. Like, you know, how many ways can you come up to kill this guy? Only have him sit right back, like, oh, here I am, let's pick up where
yeah,
we left off.
And, yeah, and he's just kind of, like, laid back about it, like, yeah, you know, nice
back
try.
Whenever the shovel finds, run him over the car, yeah, shoot him in the head. And
yeah, and that was fun to do, because it's, you know, like, the stuff, like, Creepshow 2, the Hitchhiker sequence, and of course the Terminator
right.
movies. It's just so much fun when you invent an indestructible character and you try to get rid of him over and over and over again. It's just really kind of cool. And Ron Blair, who played the lead role there as the, you know, the troubled Franklin,
right.
He was really, really cool also.
Yeah, and I was going to say about Larry, he's also pretty creepy in Twisted Illusions, too, as the crazy video store repo, man.
Right, a different, totally different aspect of him, especially
character,
that
yeah.
end speech. Looking for the tape. And that idea though, for the Twisted Illusions 2 came from actually working in the video industry. And I remember reading in Video Business Magazine, the title of the article was Deadbeat Dexters Take Away Independent Store Profits. You know, we can't get our tapes back from these guys who give us bogus credit cards and whatever. And I just thought at the time, I was like, well, you know, what if a store had a really psychotic owner or co-owner and they said, look, you got to go retrieve these tapes, you know? And that's where that whole thing came from. And it came out just at the perfect time, too, as kind of VHS was ending.
Right. Talk to me about the Truth or Dare series. Was this intended as an ongoing series, or was it, as you sort of intimate with the promotion for Deadly Dares, was it solely due to fan demand?
Well, part of it was definitely Deadly Dares. We weren't really planning to do, you know, like a fourth one, but definitely the fans were. As when Netflix started its streaming division there a few years back, Truth or Dare, the original, was one of the first movies they put on there, you know, on their horror section. And, you know, there was a kind of a renewed interest in the movie, and we did this making of documentary. And to make a long story short, yeah, the definitely, as I spoke to more and more people about the, you know, the movies, the fans had all these great memories of getting the original movie and the sequels with the Chaz Ballin artwork and all that kind of stuff. And
right.
It kind of evolved into the next question was, you know, hey, when's the fourth one coming out? I hadn't really thought about it because it had been like 10 or 12 or 13 years since we've done one. And I was like thinking, well, maybe. And then eventually I started working on a script, and actually we had a Truth or Dare remake at Lionsgate, believe it or not, which they had a changing of the guard there and canceled all that. But I was like thinking, you know, after that happened, after working on the remake for about 6 or 8 months, I was like, you know, how would I do another movie? Or if I was just starting out in the business now with kind of the HD equipment that everybody has, and I had a Truth or Dare idea for the first time, how would you present that now in today's, you know, internet age and all that? And that's where kind of Deadly Dares came from. But definitely a lot of different fans, like one guy named Matt Hill, who was always contacting me through the internet on my website and everything, were definitely inspirational in saying, you know, there is some people that actually care about all this kind of stuff, so, you know, let's try to do another one.
Was there any deliberate plan on having Mike Strauber play by a different character in each entry? I know Joel had done it in the original Twisted Illusion segment. John Brace did it in Truth or Dare. He was billed as himself in Wicked Games. He's interestingly absent in Screaming for Sanity. He's only present by influence and effects on others. And at least according to IMDb, he was played by Joel again in Deadly Dares. And also in the flashbacks, it was really by the guy who played Jesus in Reconcile, which was kind of amusing. I say this because other than the flashback, there really was no Mike in Deadly Dares, just an imposter in the twist ending. So was this a deliberate plan to keep, you know, flipping who Mike was?
Oh, it just came down to, you know, who we could actually get, you know, to play the role at the different time, and because of, you know, me moving and all that kind of thing, and because each story kind of, like in the Psycho movies, like you said, it is a different killer each time, so we could kind of get away with having, again, different perspectives when people refer back to, you know, the Truth or Dare events. You can get different people to play the character simply because, from their perspective, this mythology is completely different, and their viewpoint of who Mike Strauber was might be very tainted compared to what really happened. So in that aspect, it kind of works. And then, of course, there's this, the budgetary thing of a lot of the actors, like John Brace, who played him the first time, completely got out of acting. I believe he's like a big casting agent. And if he does the cast, I saw his name on there, and we were like, oh, wow, so now we know what he's been doing. So he's like works for a big casting agency. People, yeah, they drift away, and you just got to, you know, recast the part.
I also think it's notable that on both Screaming for Sanity and Deadly Dares, you touch on the bizarre trend of serial killer culture, where ostensibly normal people exhibit this undue fascination, like often bordering on fandom for these psychotic murders. I'm not sure if this is intended as a commentary on that trend, or if this is just more on the scripted level, with the idea that, you know, the spirit of Mike Strauber is somehow culturally viral, and he lives on in more in those whose lives he touches in one form or another than his own actions, you know, subsequent to the first movie anyway. He barely plays a part in any of the three sequels, though in another sense he's omnipresent.
Right. Exactly, and definitely the idea came from the headlines. There are, of course, people like this who are fans and of real serial killers, and there's actually women who have married serial killers and you know, even when they're incarcerated. So I kind of took these ideas and kind of integrated and maybe even exaggerated them to an extent for the Truth or Dare movies. But, you know, there are people who, you know, are really into this, and I thought it was just kind of a really cool plot line, which brings us to, there was a movie recently made based on a person who was really obsessed with, like, John Wayne Gacy. It was a really cool movie. I think it was called Dear Mr. Gacy, based on a real true story of a college guy who was so obsessed with John Wayne Gacy, they actually ended up having phone calls with him every night from when he was in prison, and then actually went to visit him, and it's a true story, and it's just fascinating And he even wrote a best-selling book on it, based, and that's what the movie's based on. So, yeah, these people are out there, and, I mean, you wonder why, and you try to kind of try to explore why in fiction sometimes. And then, you know, we all, I mean, as horror fans all love, say, Jason Voorhees or Freddy or whatever, Michael Myers.
Right.
They're not as three-dimensional as the real guy, so, you know, you just kind of wonder, try to get into the whole aspect of, you know, why people get obsessed with these kind of people, and then sometimes it does lead to the obsession with some of the real people, which can probably be pretty dangerous.
Yeah.
Or could be.
You're listening to Third Eye Cinema with a special guest tonight, Tim Ritter. Coming up, we discuss Deadly Dares and animal meat culture. Only here on Third Eye Cinema. There's an extremely dark and cynical feel in this movie, like you touched on, but even more so than your other films. You know, literally everyone here is guilty in one way or another, caught up in one perversion or another, and pretty much headed for self-destruction. The parallels between Patricia Paul's character and the revelations about her father and childhood and Joel's character and the revelations about his mother and childhood are quite interesting. What's being said, that someone driven to be a cop may be a little better or different than someone driven to be a violent criminal or a serial killer. So, again, where did this come from? You know, what was the genesis of this? Let's chat about your newest film, Truth or Dare 4, Deadly Dares. Apparently, you've been working on this last film for 4 years, between 2008 and 2011, and you had some shooting done in Florida and the rest in Kentucky. So why the move? Was this a personal life decision? And if so, how did it affect your film, since most of your current cast and crew members, outside the guys from Reconciled, were located in Florida?
Oh, yeah, it was just personal. A lot of family lives in Kentucky, so we just ended up moving up there. And plus, at the time, it seemed like the kind of the Florida indie scene was kind of getting pretty stagnant. You know, Joel and I were both having trouble, you know, keeping people interested in doing stuff for free, you know, or at a very low charge. You know, if everybody, you know, once it got so commonplace where cameras and equipment were easier to attain, it was like not really as big a deal if you're making a project anymore, and it became more difficult to, you know, kind of keep things together. So and I think you get that anywhere now, and that, like you mentioned, we haven't really had a lot of people that have stuck with us through, you know, all these movies, you know, consistently. If you get a good team, they only last so long. Even like John Waters, when he started out, you know, they did like, you know, 5 or 10 movies before everybody kind of moved on over a period of, you know, 5 or 10 years is all you kind of get before people move on. So then, you know, doing stuff up here, I kind of, you know, I definitely have a lot of Florida friends and filmmakers down there, so I always try to give them the opportunity to, you know, contribute to the, you know, whatever's next.
So this is actually the only one of your films that left me rather disturbed. Creek came close sometimes, but while it was definitely a bit of an obvious homage to, and you had mentioned this already, David Cronenberg's Videodrome here, it's really rather close to home and close to the bone in terms of what's going on with modern youth culture, with reality TV, the Jackass syndrome, you know, gonzo porn, those Uncle Cracker videos from a couple of years back, you know, sexting, kids beating up the homeless and lighting gays on fire. There's all kinds of like twisted conscienceless acts going on out there that they're capturing on video to share with friends and strangers for whatever, quote, fame it might bring, despite any consequences that might result. And there's also a strong sense of anomie in today's culture, where no one seems to have any regard for others or even themselves, and the actions and decisions that previously have been, you know, more of the purview of the mentally deranged or the substance impaired are being committed by kids and people that are ostensibly stone-cold sober. They just don't care, and there's no real regard for human life and well-being. And there's, like, this sort of one-upsmanship going on, where if one person does something crazy, everybody else jumps on the bandwagon right away. So is that, you know, this film was really cutting close to that. Was that intentional? Did you see the stuff going on and say, here's what I want to put out there? Or were you trying to make a point with this?
Definitely, yeah. It's just kind of reflective of, you know, watching news and experiencing this stuff firsthand on the internet. And I mean, you pretty much answered the question, and it's exactly, you know, why, you know, I did it like that. All these ideas came from, unfortunately, reality. Of course, not as extreme.
Yeah.
But then again, there are murders that are taking place on the internet and stuff. I mean, it started out with, just briefly, it just started out, I started to, you know, look at some videos on YouTube, and there's these two, and it was like, came up on the front page, it was like one of the most viewed, and it was like these guys going around the gas stations that didn't charge first, and they were just filling up their tank, and then tearing out a little lot and not paying for it, and there you see the owner running after them, and I was like going, is this for real? And it turned out they were real. They were taken off the internet, and then later, you know, I read on the news articles that these guys had done all kinds of crazy things, and it just started to go from there. And of course, you know, I did exaggerate some things, but you are absolutely correct. We have entered an internet era where people are posting dangerous, personal, crazy things on there that they shouldn't have and that shouldn't be doing at all. And it is kind of a commentary on what's happening on your computer screen.
Yeah, because I mean, all told, until we get to the ending where we get right back into a more typical, you know, Tim Ritter territory, where thematically and in terms of unexpected plot twists, the sense of untrustworthiness of people, and even our own senses, sins catching up with us, all that sort of thing. This one really felt real. Like, not only could it happen, but that it very much is happening on a certain level all around us. So, you know, like I said, was this intended as a deliberate didactic treatise like Reconciled was, where, you know, the underlying action is really just there as window dressing to make this thematic point?
Definitely, yeah, because, I mean, like you're saying, you're seeing it too, right?
Yeah, exactly.
You can see it in society. So it is taking, you know, it is kind of a reflection. And maybe, hopefully, it makes people think, you know, is this, you know, are things going too far? And in many ways, they've already gone too far. Like you said, with the, you know, the bums being beat up. And, I mean, I've seen videos where kids destroy their schools, mailboxes, houses. You know, they burn up stuff. And, of course, these things get yanked down, or later they become viral, you know, once the court trial and everything happens. Then, you know, eventually somehow they release the, you know, what they've done, and they put it on the internet. So it's very strange. And then there's also some people who are trying to make things look real on the internet when they're not, you know, look like they do look like they did something that they didn't do, and they're getting in trouble for that too. So so the line between what's real and what's not is continually being blurred. And the other thing is, it is very sad, you know, some of the people who are actually, you know, committing suicide and putting it on their webcam.
Yes.
Stuff. I mean, it's
a very strange world we're entering into.
Yeah. And sadly, it's such a schadenfreude world that people look for stuff like that because it makes them feel better watching other people just self-destruct. And
watch somebody else fall apart and this will make you feel happy somehow. Mm-hmm. It's not worth getting into. Now, also, I should mention that you have on your website, you have put out the soundtrack to this film in cooperation with the composer, basically as a free download, which I thought was interesting. I know we were discussing that offline here. So did you want to mention anything about that and your motivation there?
Just, you know, of course, in the internet world, we're just trying to, you know, we had a re-release of Truth or Dare on DVD, and it didn't do as well as expected, but then when you go to the BitTorrent sites, you see, you know, some websites where it's been downloaded, you know, like 10,000 times or so. So, you know, in a world where a lot of people are downloading stuff for free, whether it's legal or not, we're just trying to kind of embrace the technology, and we figured trying to figure out various things that to promote the movie and get people excited about it. Like in the old days, before all the internet and everything, I would go to the record store, and you know, if I wasn't even old enough to see the movies, but I would buy a soundtrack like Maniac and listen to it for sometimes years before I actually was able to actually legitimately see the movie. So we're trying to put some of that, you know, magic back into people who like soundtracks and look forward to horror movies. So we figured, you know, a cool soundtrack where they could listen to sound bites and some of the awesome score that, you know, that was done for the movie. We figured that all that would, you know, play into helping to publicize the movie. So, and like we were talking about before, people, the diehard fans are going to, you know, they're going to want physical copies of whatever it is, whether it's a VHS and a CD or a DVD, you know, eventually they're going to buy it. And then there's also the people, if they just want to download it and enjoy it. So we figured we'd try to kind of cater to both markets at the same time, and hopefully it leads to, you know, the budget getting paid back. But if not, you know, this movie really wasn't made to, you know, make a killing for anybody financially. It's really myself, who's a fan, with other fans, we're just trying to, you know, do something, you know, cool that hopefully people enjoy. And that was, you know, that was kind of the thinking behind it, besides the, you know, the commentary, which was, is just, you know, a plot device, of course. So, but you know, that is there too. So you can, just depends on what you want to take away from it.
You've also written a few books in addition to your filmmaking career. You contributed some advice and techniques to a chapter or so in two books on independent filmmaking, making movies on your own in the independent film experience. And then you wrote two novels, The Hammer Will Fall, which is about an ex-cop who winds up becoming a shop teacher and taking on a gang that terrorizes the school he works at, and Unreal, which is a semi-autobiographical story about following your dreams to become an independent horror movie maker. So tell us about these.
Well, basically, you know, I just wanted, you know, being a fan of Stephen King and Jack Ketchum and all that, you know, I'd always wanted, even as a little kid, I'd always wanted to try, you know, doing novels at some point. And it just kind of, you know, it remained elusive. The scripts were easier. But then when I got to a certain point in life where, you know, I'd live more and where I could, you know, had more to say maybe, and, you know, on paper, I felt comfortable enough to try to tackle, you know, a couple of books. And, you know, they worked out pretty well. The Hammer Will Fall was actually started out as a script that over the years I've been unable to get finance anywhere, and part of that is, you know, it needs a budget, first of all. It's one of those ones that you really can't do too well without some kind of budget. So I was like, you know, maybe we'll get it out on paper and, you know, at least let people enjoy it from that way. And it did pretty well. It sold in a bunch of foreign markets and everything. And, you know, it's pretty much about a shop teacher who comes up against a group of kids. And, of course, school violence is a subject that's very hard to get financed, of course, you know,
yeah,
especially in today's world, as we're just talking about with, you know, that could probably be updated with the video and cell phone and, you know, internet and all that kind of stuff, you know, pretty neatly. And then, you know, the other one, you know, then I went in a completely different direction with kind of Unreal. It's more of like a fictional autobiography. In other words, it has a lot of real stuff in it that really happened. And then there's also kind of, so I could distance myself from it and kind of reflect on it more, you know, some fictional bookends. One chapter is real, one chapter is fake. But it's got all the old war stories of, you know, making these kind of movies in there, along with,
right,
you know, some sort of perspective on there. And they're both fun to do, and hopefully, you know, in the future I will do more. And, of course, Kevin Lindemuth wrote the books that I contributed to. He did the Alien Agenda movies, which we talked about earlier. And I think he's even working on a new book now on independent filmmaking, because, of course, with time and technology, you know, a lot of stuff gets outdated, you know, the following week that you write about it. And those,
right,
are fun to contribute to. As a matter of fact, I'm hopefully going to contribute a chapter to a book that he's working on right now. So,
do you have any favorites among your films today? I mean, speaking personally, I would say Killing Spree, Reconciled, and Wicked Games seem to be the most, quote, complete among your films, with, you know, your typical numerous twists and turns in the plot, plenty of misdirection, some comedy thrown in for good measure. And they hit pretty much all of your thematic signposts along the way. What's your take? What are your favorites?
I would probably have to say Wicked Games and Reconciled. You know, Wicked Games, it was just so, even though we had a lot of camera problems and everything, it was just such a fun time, you know, shooting it. And the effects that we had came out, even though they were kind of homemade effects, but we had some really cool effects guys out of L.A. who, you know, made the stuff for us. Specifically, and we had Joel Harlow, who made the Copper Mask. He's gone on to win Academy Awards for special makeup effects, and, you know, he started out with us on Killing Spree. So it was just really fun to do, you know, use some of his props in Wicked Games, and then, you know, I got the opportunity to do the, you know, that other cut. So there's two separate cuts out of Wicked Games that really, they're so different.
Yeah, I'd really like to see that other one.
So, yeah, so it was just really fun. And then, of course, Reconciled, it just pretty much went so smooth. It was a movie that came out, even though it was only like a $3,500 budget, it was a movie that I sat down and I wrote, and I envisioned it, and it came out so close to the way I envisioned it, simply because, you know, I've been doing this for so long, and I knew, you know, what in my mind, I knew pretty much what I could do. And the CGI effects by Todd Ponsler came out really, really, really cool for, you know, the time period that we did it. I'm sure by now the technology is home computers all these years later. Probably blow that away now with, you know, very simple programs. But at the time it really, you know, and it's, to me, it's still, most of it still holds up pretty well.
Reaper Jones, he was Franklin, and he also did casting and co-produced on all three films, being Reconciled, Twist Illusions 2, and Truth or Dare 4. This guy really seems intense on screen. He was quite believable as a would-be serial killer. There's something about his eyes and the coldness and suddenness of his delivery right before he goes into action every time. Even if, like, the typical churchgoer had accepted the rest of that film, just that alone would probably put them off. You know, tell us a little bit about him.
Right, right. Yeah, he's an awesome guy, again, you know, from Kentucky that we hooked up with through Professor Tread. He was he ended up being in the NCAP epilogue of Twisted Illusions 2, our segment there. And he knew all about my movies, and he was just a fan, and started talking with him, and he had the passion to be an actor, and he reminded me of Joel with Joel's enthusiasm, and I was like, going, hey, the next movie right. that I do, I'm going to get you in it. And yeah, he played that role to a T.
Yeah.
And he really, you know, did a super job without much directing at all. I mean, he pretty much became that character, and it was just, you know, really fun to work with. And again, he was just kind of spot on with everything, knew his dialogue and was cool with the marks and everything. And I guess the thing about Reconcile was because it's just pretty much those two characters, you know, take up the bulk of the time,
right.
and really believe that, you know, they're talking like that, and and you're really interested in it because they pull it off so well. So it's just, you know, pretty cool. So
all right, well, that's all I had for you. So it was a great interview. Thanks for your time. Hopefully we'll keep in touch and look forward to more stuff coming out from you in the future. Do you have anything in the works? Do you have another movie planned out? Or
no, we're still working on Deadly Dares, and hopefully 2012 we'll just be showing it, you know, on HD cut, a new cut coming out somewhere in the middle of the year. So look for that, and you can just go to my website, timritter.com, and from there, if you go on the, you know, the update section, you can find the Facebook page and the MySpace page and all that kind of stuff, and, you know, keep in touch with everything. And as you guys know, as artists, it takes so long to, you got to really stick with the project and keep with it to the bitter end there. But hopefully there'll be some new, you know, new stuff coming along, you know, sometime in 2012 we'll begin to do something, as time and money permit.
Thanks for joining us tonight. We hope you enjoyed our up-close and personal interview with Tim Ritter. In 2 weeks, on week 34 of Third Eye Cinema, Gigi Hangash of all-female Shred Legends Phantom Blue. If you'd like to contact us here, comments, suggestions, or you're a filmmaker or musician like to join us on air, email us at thirdeyecinema@hotmail.com or visit our Facebook page, facebook.com/thirdeyecinema. Third Eye Cinema, brought to you by Big Papa Online Network on Blog Talk Radio. This or any other Third Eye Cinema broadcast, just visit our Facebook page for links to the shows in question. All Blog Talk Radio shows are available for archive listener download at your convenience. You can also check out our new website, thirdeyecinema.wordpress.com.
What's in store for your business this week at Staples? Doing business like a CEO while saving like a CFO.
Staples has all the supplies you need to run your business like a boss at prices that'll make your bookkeeper smile.
Now that is an achievement.
Everything from markers and pens to 2019 desk calendars.
And right now, a 12-pack of Sharpie markers and an 8-pack of Expo dry erase markers are only $4.99 each.
At Staples, where there's a whole lot in store. Ends 1/19/19 in store only.